Hello, friends, and welcome to episode 1170 of the Juice Box Podcast. Today on the podcast, I'll be speaking with Jeannie, who was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes in 1965 at the age of 12. Jeannie is a retired nurse who loves helping people, and today we're going to talk about the differences between diabetes back in the day and today. We're going to talk about diabetes camp, community, and so much more. Please don't forget that nothing you hear on the Juice Box Podcast should be considered advice, medical or otherwise. Always consult a physician before making any changes to your healthcare plan or becoming bold with insulin. If you're not already subscribed or following in your favorite audio app, please take the time now to do that. It really helps the show. And get those automatic downloads set up so you never miss an episode. When you place your first order for AG1 with my link, you'll get 5 free travel packs and a free year's supply of vitamin D. drinkag1.com/juicebox. Don't forget to save 40% off of your entire order at CozyEarth.com. All you have to do is use the offer code JUICEBOX at checkout. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by Touched by Type 1. TouchedByType1.org. And find them on Facebook and Instagram. Touched by Type 1 is an organization dedicated to helping people living with type 1 diabetes. And they have so many different programs that are doing just that. Check them out at touchedbytype1.org. US Med is sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast, and we've been getting our diabetes supplies from US Med for years. You can as well. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or the number, get your free benefits check, and get started today with US Med. This episode of the Juice Box Podcast is sponsored by the Eversense CGM. And sure, all CGM systems use transcutaneous sensors that are inserted into the skin and last 7 to 14 days. But the Eversense sensor is inserted completely under the skin, lasting 6 months. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox.
Good morning. I'm Jeannie Hickey. I'm a diabetes nurse, retired. But I was diagnosed with diabetes in 1965 and have been very involved with camps for type 1 diabetics and families since 2003.
All right, Jeannie.
So that's why I'm here today.
You were diagnosed in 65. How old were you then?
I was 12.
12?
Yes.
If you whisper, they can't hear you, but I'm just going to repeat it loud enough. Don't worry.
I know. Yeah, I was 12.
Well, we can do the math easy on this one, right?
Because I know that's the scary part.
Yeah, 40 years is 2005, so 50 is 2015, so 60 is next year, and then are you 71?
Yes.
Look at me, Jeannie. Jeannie, I am a math wizard when it comes to tens. I can do the tens, no problem.
That's because we have diabetes. We have to be math strong.
Well, Jeannie, do you know I don't?
Oh, you don't.
Yeah, I was going to say, do you know I don't have diabetes, right?
It's your daughter.
Yeah, my daughter, Arden, who is going to be 20 this summer.
Wow. Yeah,
she was diagnosed when she was 2.
That's a tough place. Terrible twos.
Not a great deal of fun, if you're wondering. So.
Yes. Yeah.
You're diagnosed in 65 at 12 years old. I'd like to pick through it just for a couple minutes. I want to get to the real reason you're here. But, you know, first, I mean, are you regular and NPH, or is that still like beef and pork?
I started on regular and NPH after I went to camp, because my parents took me like 6 or 8 weeks after diagnosis. I went to camp. There was a doctor up there, and we got a letter from him saying he was pleased that we were already on twice a day injections.
Oh, you were in the future already.
Yeah.
What do you remember about that? Do you remember anything about it? I mean, it's a long time ago, but what was it like?
Yeah. Well, I remember, you know, it was definitely outdoors, camp was, and, you know, walking down the hill with my cup of urine, sitting in front of a fireplace, and I guess it was raining. So we were roasting marshmallows and having s'mores. Mm. And I thought, oh, I can do this. I can have a s'more, you know, the chocolate and the marshmallow.
Yeah, yeah.
And so it was already a quick opening. And then just having other kids there. But back then, you didn't tell people because they didn't need to know.
Mm. So it offered you a sense of normalcy right away.
Yes. Okay. And just companions who understood, didn't have to explain things.
And they understood your day.
Yeah.
What was your day? What did it look like having diabetes when you were 12 and 65?
You know, I really don't remember, other than I remember sitting in the bathroom trying, I'd drawn up my insulin and trying to get the needle into my thigh, sitting there and aiming and bobbing the needle and just putting it off and having to talk to myself saying, just get it over with. And then it's done and you've got the rest of the day. Mm-hmm. So it was, you know, I'm sure that a lot of kids did that before the auto injectors came out. And now everybody's put on a pump so quickly. But my mom kind of measured my food because there was the exchange diet where you had, you know, one or two servings of this, one or two servings of that. And that was what you were supposed to eat every day. Mm-hmm. The fat, you were supposed to have so much fat every day. There's a joke at camp about all the pats of butter that were underneath the tables.
Because people were like trying to get their groups together. The fat, the was there
yes.
carbs, was there, what do you remember what the groups were they wanted you to do?
Fruit, milk, starch, protein, vegetable, fat.
Just like that. And then your doctor made adjustments to the amount of insulin you used? Or did that not really happen very often?
It didn't happen very often because remember, we just did a urine test every morning. I really don't remember doing one later in the day. Mm-hmm. You know, 5 drops of urine, 10 drops of water, drop in the tablet. And I still have my test tube. You know, you dropped it all in and then you watched it bubble and fuzzle up and you'd get a color.
Bubble and fuzzle?
And then Bubble and Fuzzle. Yeah.
I got to tell you right now, Bubble and Fuzzle could be the name of your episode, Jeannie. That was great. I'm jotting that down.
And then what's fun, or just time-wise, you know, you'd take this colored test tube and you'd move it across the color scale that came with the box of tablets. So you would have this sliding scale as you got the color and you would know whether you were negative trace or 4+ on the sugar. And at some point in time, they started saying, if you are, then you can add this much more of regular.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah.
In the beginning, it was just do the test. But at some point, it became do the test. And if it's a certain color, you can add a little insulin. The podcast is sponsored today by Eversense CGM. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. With Eversense, there's no need for frequent sensor changes. No more sensors falling off, fewer failed sensors, and less skin irritations. And that means more comfort. With Eversense, you only need one sensor insertion every 6 months. And there's no need for constant sensor changes, which means less hassle. There's also no need to carry extra sensors with you, so that's less stuff to worry about. And you can say goodbye to unexpected disruptions from sensors falling off or being knocked off, because the Eversense CGM is implantable and the sensor stays comfortably in place for 6 months. The Eversense sensor is incredibly durable. And of course, that means fewer frequent unexpected sensor errors that happen before the end of the suggested wear time. But what do you really want to know about? Accuracy. The Eversense CGM performs exceptionally over its 6-month life. If you'd like more details or are interested in getting started, use my link, EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. I'll be telling you a lot more about Eversense this year, so make sure you pay attention to upcoming advertisements. There you'll learn about the implantable sensor, the smart transmitter, and their mobile application. The Eversense CGM lasts up to 6 months, eliminating the hassle and discomfort of frequent sensor insertions. Simply put, it makes managing your diabetes so much easier. EversenseCGM.com/juicebox. I'm starting to take it for granted. I am. I'm starting to take for granted that Arden's diabetes supplies just show up. But they do, because of US Med. USMed.com/juicebox. we get an email that says, you know, do you want to refill your order? And you click and say yes, and then it just comes to the door. There's not a lot to say when things are done well. Yeah, I could stand here and tell you US Med carries Omnipod 5, Omnipod Dash, Dexcom G7, G6, Tandem X2, Libre 3, Libre 2. I mean, they've got, there's so much. I'm not even listing it all. I should be. I will at the end, I promise. My point is this. It just works. And we don't talk about things enough when they just work. usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514. Get your free benefits check and get started today with the white glove treatment offered by US Med. US Med, here's what they got. Freestyle Libre 3 and 2, they got it. Omnipod Dash, yes. Omnipod 5, uh-huh. Tandem, yep. What about, have they served a million people with diabetes since 1996? They have. Better service and better care is what you're going to get from US Med, but you're also going to get 90 days worth of supplies and fast and free shipping. They carry everything from insulin pumps to diabetes testing supplies, the latest CGMs, and they accept Medicare nationwide. Find out why US Med has an A-plus rating with the Better Business Bureau at usmed.com/juicebox or call 888-721-1514.
Yeah, yeah.
Because back then, all you were doing was trying to cover meals, right? Like you had to eat on a schedule too, I would imagine, times a day.
Right, scales. And then remember, it was NPH. Mm-hmm. So you were supposed to have an afternoon snack and a bedtime snack because of the peak of NPH.
Yeah, where the insulin hit.
Yeah, right. Even if you weren't hungry, you had to have a snack. And boy, did that carry over many, many, many years, even when people were no longer on NPH. They still thought they had to have a bedtime snack. They had to eat when they didn't want to.
Yeah, it was so ingrained in them by the time that the insulin kind of leveled up and wasn't necessary anymore. They were still doing that thing.
Yeah, Scott.
Every day starts with the smell of urine and ends with a snack you don't want.
There you go. There you go. Did you have to do that with your daughter?
Oh, Arden started with Levemir and
nice
Novolog. Those were her two first insulins. Yeah. So, I mean, after that, we had a meter that looked like it came out of a bubblegum machine and nothing else. That was what we had.
So meters were about, or I guess test strips were about 78, 79. Then you had a strip that you could stick into a meter.
But they needed like a ton of blood, right?
Yeah, it was a good drop. And we were supposed to, you weren't supposed to squeeze because they felt that it got more serum into the blood and it would change the value of that blood sample. So we were not supposed to squeeze. So that meant you had to hit it pretty hard.
And then just sit there holding your finger upside down, letting the blood drip out of it?
Yeah.
How much time do you think in the morning was spent with your diabetes back then?
What a question. Oh, probably a good 20 minutes, half hour.
Yeah, it sucks. Especially if you're in a hurry or if you can't sleep in. You can't just jump up and go. Timing. Yeah, it takes a lot away from your ability to move around. Mm-hmm. So you growing up with this, I mean, you're really just, once you get over the, I can't put this needle in my leg, once you get over that, you're basically on your own. Are your parents very involved?
I mean, yes and no. Mom didn't, you know, ask every day what my urine sugar was. But she was helpful, very helpful in getting a meal, planning the meals and giving the snacks and stuff. I left home when I was 16, went to college.
Wait, you went to college when you were 16?
Yeah, right. About a couple of weeks after I graduated from high school.
You graduated from high school in time to start college when you were 16. Are you very smart, Jeannie?
Well, I think I turned 17 while I was gone that summer.
Okay. But
I'm not that smart.
Oh, I thought maybe you were a savant. You were like, we've got to get her off into the world where she could do some good.
I wanted to start med school.
Did you? What did you end up going to college for?
Pre-med.
You did. And did you finish?
Yeah. No. After a year, I said, I don't like all these classes that I have to take. So I came home and worked on getting my AA and met a school nurse. And she finally said, Jeannie, go to a hospital program and become a nurse. You want people. Mm-hmm. So I did, and I've loved it.
Oh, that's amazing. How long did you do it for?
Well, let's see. I graduated from nursing school, Merit, in Oakland in 75, and then I just retired in 16.
You just retired?
Yeah. Yeah, no 16, so like 6 years ago.
Good for you.
But I still do a lot. I'm still very active with the type 1 community.
Yeah. I don't want to make you feel bad, but I was 4 in 1975.
You little rapscallion.
And Jeannie, I'm old now. So what are we talking about here? You know what I'm saying?
I don't feel old, and I hope you don't either.
My shoulders a little sometimes, but actually, if you're actually asking me, I feel so much better today in January than I did last year in January. I started using a GLP medication just for weight. Mm-hmm. Initially, it was for weight in March. And this morning when I got on the scale, it told me that I am 43 pounds lighter than I was the day I started in March.
That is wonderful. There are so many people who their prescriptions stop because the medication's not available. Mm. There's a woman that I know in one of the support groups. She couldn't get it anymore.
Yeah. It's going to be very, very widely used. They need to ramp up and keep ramping up. My daughter, who is 20, is using just 0.25 of Ozempic a week.
Wow.
And it brought her hourly basal from 1.1 to 0.7.
Yes.
Her insulin sensitivity went from 1 unit moves her 42 to 1 unit moves her 63.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah. Yeah. And my calculations tell me she's going to use 11,000 fewer units of insulin this year.
Wow. The math wizard. That's wonderful. Great.
Well, I did it earlier. I just remembered it. So, but seriously, the impact is crazy. I've got a lot of people coming on the podcast this year who are experiencing exactly the same things. Even one little girl who full-blown type 1 for 3 years, who now looks almost Lada because of starting, I think, Wegovy for weight loss, which is just Ozempic.
Yeah.
It's interesting what they're figuring out. All the way back from, hey, Jeannie, just shoot this in the morning, and if the box is a different color, you can use a little more, to a quarter of a milligram of this once a week will, you know, is dropping. I'm not saying it would work for everybody, obviously, but it's going to drop my daughter's insulin sensitivity, or her insulin needs that much anyway. And it's impacting other things.
And for a lot of people, it's the food, you know, it lasts longer, you feel fuller sooner. And so it's just easier to start backing off on those extra calories.
Yeah.
Huge difference.
Her eating is definitely different. Mm. But I will tell you that the insulin needs changed in the first week immediately.
Yes.
Even I was told by the endocrinologist that helped me, you know, Scott, when you start this, you're not going to lose weight right away. And I was like, okay. She's like, this is a non-therapeutic dose of this. It takes a month for it to build up. We're just getting your system used to it. Mm-hmm. In 4 or 5 days, I lost 4 pounds. I think you're going to see people being supplemented for GLP almost the way you see people supplemented for their thyroid hormone.
Yeah.
For example.
And so you're just making me realize that there's going to be a lot more people at camp this summer, youngsters.
Yep.
Who could be on it.
At first, the families, the insurance isn't covering it right now. You have to figure out a way to get it or pay cash for it.
Right.
We're very lucky in that Arden's dose is not going to rise. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, for us, what is a reasonable cash outlay for the entire year? Mm-hmm. We're going to be able to impact her health this way because a pen's going to last her forever. So
wonderful.
Yeah.
Isn't that great?
It's terrific. It's amazing how it keeps going.
How far we've come.
Of course. And I think you make these advancements because of community backing.
Yes.
Right. And to really bring it right back to you. If you've been going to these, you know, you took your experience at camp, and which obviously led you on a good path, mm-hmm. and you've been helping other people with this, you know, throughout your life through nursing and now, you know, staying with community after your retirement from nursing. I don't actually see that as being much different than me sharing a story about my daughter using 0.25 of Ozempic.
Exactly.
You know, I think it's the same thing, actually. Tell me more about it.
More about what?
More about how you got involved with people. And what you got out of it, what kept you doing it, and what you think it's bringing to them.
I guess one of the things I'll say about myself is I'm a fuss budget. I'm a fixer. I have a good friend who's a teacher, and she's already always saying, what would you do? And I'm always saying, have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? I share what I've heard from other people, and I challenge people to think about it. And to me, that's one of the exciting things about having type 1 diabetes is that we're pushy. We're asking. We're figuring out. You know, just because FDA doesn't say that you can do it, if it works better for you, dadgummit, do it.
Yeah.
Try it. Share the idea. You just may help the next person you talk to make a little bit of their diabetes a little bit easier.
Mm-hmm.
We've got choices. But, you know, you go to the endo or the some of the nurses and they open the book. And if it's not in the book, then you don't talk about it.
Yeah.
But that's the fun thing of community. You know, everybody's pushing that. It's like that whole we are not waiting. You know, what can we do to make my life a little bit easier? And that to me is the fun. I love it.
I'm happy you do because there's an argument, like, you know, you'll hear me at any point in time. I'm not shy about pointing out that generally speaking, clinicians are underwhelming as far as their value for people using insulin.
Oh, yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I have two concurrent series that are going right now. One is called Grand Rounds, where myself and Jenny Smith, Jenny is a CDE. Yeah. You know Jenny, right? She's had diabetes for like 35 years. We're talking directly to physicians about what they need to know and what they need to be doing.
Mm-hmm.
The series was built around feedback from a Facebook group with 45,000 members in it. I went to them a year ago and I said, tell me, you know, what you wish the doctors would have said to you.
Mm-hmm.
And we compiled 86 pages of answers.
Wow.
Pared them down to, you know, took out the duplicates, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And then Jenny and I went through them together while we were recording. And we built about a 10-part series using the people's questions. And then she and I are having these 45-minute, hour-long conversations on each topic.
Right.
And the idea is we're delivering them to doctors, but it's also incredibly valuable for patients because they can say to themselves, well, if my doctor's not offering these things, I know these are the things I need and deserve, even if I'm not aware of it.
Right.
This thing's telling me that.
Yeah.
Through having those conversations, I started asking doctors to come on because my first idea was, I'll let them tell me why it is they don't know more, you know, and what it turned into was a group of clinicians willing to speak anonymously. Jeannie, I actually change their voices. I do a voice altering for them, so you can't tell who they are.
Okay.
They don't use their names. And they are telling us about all the things that they see at their jobs. And so far, I've talked to an ER nurse, a bedside nurse, an in-hospital inpatient pharmacist, a human resources professional. I've talked to an actual CDE. And these people they're just spilling their guts about what's happening in these places and what they don't know and what everybody doesn't know. And it's as much as I feel like I knew it already, to hear someone say it, it's different, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, I agree. Yeah. I'm going to be doing a talk Wednesday, a JDRF talk, and it's what does a CDE do? And it's like, well, so all of these very many people can become a CDE.
Mm-hmm.
So is an exercise physiologist going to help you with your insulin to carb ratio? Not necessarily.
Right.
So you've got to try and figure out what CDE do you want to help you work? What are your problems? It's just the variety. And there's, you know, every doctor, every hospital worker out there has their own interests. And it's finding someone who meets your challengeability,
mm-hmm.
who's willing. That's where I got started when I was working in the ER, is my coworkers would say, come talk to this person. Okay, you know, what brought you in here? What's going wrong? Have you thought about this? Have you thought about that? Challenge your doctor about this. And so they finally kicked me out and told me to go find a diabetes educator job.
Can I ask you because I ask this of all the people in these that I'm having these conversations with, why is it so difficult or why is it so unreasonable for us to expect a nurse in a hospital to understand how insulin works?
Because we're complicated people. Type 1 diabetes is so complicated. I mean, there are even endocrinologists that don't like type 1 diabetes because you can't fix it. Mm-hmm. You're constantly juggling, thinking, redoing, you know, did you exercise today or not? Are you stressed? Did your cat wake you up overnight and so you slept badly? There's so many variables that change our day. And it's almost too much for some people to feel comfortable with.
And so it's not taught in nursing or medical school, like nursing school. Like for, I mean, I have nursed a day or a page, they usually tell me when I ask them.
Yeah, there you go.
But they're also trying to learn everything. And so that's understandable. Yes. My question is, after it happens over and over and over again, why doesn't it not get retained?
Again, I think it's because of the variability. If I talk to your daughter, her practices with herself are very different than mine. I've got people who, you may know, a Jessica, who is very much into exercise, and the way she handles her insulin is very different than what I need to do to handle my exercise. I just got off the bike, and what's my sugar? My sugar's okay. So things are changing so much, Scott, and so quickly. We didn't used to have our blood sugar on our watch, and now we're constantly aware of it. And so we're constantly thinking, or I shouldn't say that. I am constantly thinking. Some people don't want to think. But then again, with my loop, I don't necessarily need to think about what my blood sugar is because I know it's going to be pretty darn close to where I want it to be.
I find that the do-it-yourself algorithms, my daughter's using IAPS right now, but she used Loop for a long time with auto-bolus branch of Loop.
Okay, yeah.
I find that with very good settings, a firm understanding of, you know, your carb ratios and how to, you know, count your carbs or bolus specifically well, good timing with your insulin, you can generally expect that thing to keep you under 180 and above 50.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and 50 once in a while. Mm-hmm. But most of the time, she sits between like 80 and 110.
Yeah.
It's really something.
The simpler you keep your life. Yeah, right. Exercise, don't exercise. Go to a party, don't go to. It's the pumps that really help.
Yeah. I'll break your brain for a second. Yeah. So I know you don't know me that well. I know somebody drove you to me, Stephen.
Yes.
Introduced us. But I have, at this moment, when you and I are speaking, over 1,100 episodes of this podcast are recorded and available.
Yes.
Been out for 10 years, right?
Yeah.
I have been recently feeding the podcast into AI, I guess, is the simplest way to ask it. So while you were talking just now, I chose an episode of this podcast that is myself and Jenny Smith. And we're having a conversation just like you and I are, but we are specifically talking about how to figure out your insulin to carb ratio. Mm-hmm. Now it's not a bullet point conversation. It's just the way you and I are talking right now. I just asked that episode through AI. I said, how do I calculate insulin to carb ratio? That's all I asked it. It told me to calculate your insulin to carb ratio, you can use the 500 rule mentioned in the podcast transcript. Here's how you can do it. Number one, determine your total daily insulin dose, which includes both basal and bolus insulin. Take the number 500 and divide it by your total daily dose of insulin. The result will give you an average insulin to carb ratio. For example, if the result is 16.6, your ratio would be one unit of insulin for every 16.6 grams of carbohydrates. Mm-hmm. Keep in mind that the 500 rule is a starting point, and that's it. That's me asking a computer that has listened to that episode of the podcast to come up with that idea.
Okay.
That's where this stuff is headed. Instead of you having to there's going to be a time where you can go to a webpage and say, I am a 150-pound male who is moderately active. What do you think my total daily insulin is? And it's going to give you a range of where to look for your total daily insulin.
And that's like the iLet pump, the Beta Bionics iLet. That's all they want to know is your weight.
Yep. It's all it's doing.
Yeah.
So what I learned was it makes me how do I want to put this? I wish that every conversation you've ever had with a kid or with somebody at a camp or another adult with type 1 diabetes, I wish you recorded it. I wish we had it so we could feed it into that and say to it, what are Jeannie's rules for living well with type 1 diabetes? Because believe it or not, it would come back with a comprehensive list that sounded like you wrote it. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. I am working. That's going to be the last thing I do in this space before I leave. I'm going to leave a computer behind for people to ask questions to.
Mm-hmm. So. I know on my endo, when I saw her, she asked me, we were talking about having best practices or good ideas or wonderful tips. And there should be a list of wonderful tips. And that's, I think, what you're talking about.
It's not only going to be able to answer every one of your questions that you can imagine, but it's going to be able to take the information that it knows and tell you what questions you should have, just in case you don't even know which ones to ask.
Wonderful.
I'm telling you, it's insane. It all comes down to having recorded, making data out of these conversations. Because it just occurred to me one day, I started saying it like this. So I have this big Facebook group, right? It has 45,000 people with diabetes in it. It adds 150 new people every 4 days.
Wow.
Every day, there are about 100 to 125 new posts that generate over 8,000 comments, hearts, and likes every day. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And one time this person asked a question and they said, it's a pretty basic question. And someone kind of came in and said, you could search the group for that. And I stopped them. I didn't slap their hand, but I came in. I said, no, you don't want that. You don't want somebody to start searching the group because the group is a living organism. And if people stop interacting in it, then the group dies and then all the information inside of it goes away with it. And I found myself thinking personally, it's a shame because every question that is ever asked in this group has been answered in that podcast. Mm-hmm. And they just don't know how to get to it.
There you go.
And then one day I was listening to an artificial intelligence expert talking about how they're going to use AI in the future for something. And I thought I could do that with the podcast. That would work. Mm-hmm. And I know that this is like a generation beyond what you probably think about when you're thinking about computers, but trust me, I'm going to take community and turn it into actual value for people beyond what we've done here so far.
Wouldn't that be exciting?
It's going to be really exciting for people. I mean, just try to imagine being able to sit at a browser and tell it, I just went on an insulin pump. I weigh this much weight. I'm 15 years old. I get my period and please give me my settings. And it tells you, here's the range to put this, here's the range to put that. And everybody just goes in, puts the low range, adjusts it up, gets it to where it needs to be, and they're on their way.
And then you've got your week before the period, the week of your period, and then you've got the Friday night basketball game with jumping up and down.
but Jeannie, those people are going to be on algorithms.
Yeah.
It's going to be different, right? Like it's a bad week before your period is going to go from what 15 years ago was, blood sugars in the 250s, spikes into the 300s, stuff you couldn't get down for days, like that kind of thing. Like, oh, that's going to turn into, I had a 180 blood sugar for a few hours today.
Yeah.
It's really
and maybe
beautiful.
That'll be that quick part of AI learning so that the pump is aware of the calendar.
Yep.
Aware of, okay, we're starting to see some high blood sugars. Mm-hmm. Calendar. Let's raise the basal a little bit.
One of the most exciting things somebody has said to me on this podcast, it's very forward thinking, but he said, imagine an algorithm that was also location based that knew that when you were at Pizza Parlor A, your insulin needs were greater than when you were at Pizza Parlor B.
Oh, wow. Yes.
And then the next time you're at B, you can tell it, I'm having two slices of pizza, and it will actually remember what it took last time to do it and try to mimic it. That's not crazy with the technology that exists right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or just to be able to say, hey, I'm driving to the park.
Yep. Well, that's it. Yeah. Just to literally be able to pick up your phone and say, I'm leaving now for the park.
Yeah.
And then the algorithm can experience what you're doing and then see what happens. And then maybe the third or fourth time you say, I'm leaving now for the park, it'll go, oh, she's going to the park. I know what to do here. Mm-hmm. You need somebody to develop that.
Yeah.
But it's not crazy. And I guarantee you it comes through the community way before it comes through a company.
And it's just a little bit better than us remembering late to do it.
Yeah, right. Half an hour into your walk and you're like, oh, I didn't do a temp basal decrease.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Bali, people still do that. Oh, yeah.
I hope so. People listen to this podcast. I hope they're doing it. We talk all the time about, I think the core of diabetes, I don't disregard your point that everybody is different. But I think at its core, if your basal is well set, if you know how to pre-bolus your meals, if you understand the impacts of different foods, I think diabetes is pretty similar for most people at that core stuff. Now there's variables off of that that will change. But if you can get that stuff together, that's an A1C in the sixes, you know?
And that's the wonderful thing about listening to other people. They challenge you to try something new, or they confirm what you're doing and make you feel good about it. But it's, you know, it's the community. It's just listening and learning and thinking and not feeling like you're so alone, not feeling like you're just absolutely terrible because you can't get it right. Yeah. It's like, this is kind of the way it is. And there is some hope because this person has a similar situation and they're pleased now. Yeah. So I could learn something.
No, the community aspect of it is so valuable. I've always known it, but I understand it differently now after making this podcast and actually after building a Facebook group that houses that many people and helps them so much. Like I can now, I really see the value in it. You know, before I just knew it as a concept, people need people, you know, all those kind of basic ideas. But when I watched it happen in real time, then I thought, this is much more valuable. This might be half of it. I'm just going to say a name. Most people aren't going to know, but there's this man named Bennett Dunlap who did a lot of great things in the diabetes community over the years. And I once was sitting somewhere with him where he said that diabetes is like a certain percent math and a certain percent magic or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you know, and the magic was just your understanding of how it all worked. You know, like your ability to just kind of bounce through it and get it right.
Yeah. And what you were saying with community is so much about what people get from camp, because when you're diagnosed, you're so alone. Mm-hmm. You don't get people. You don't get the share, the encouragement, the ideas. And that's just a wonderful thing that parents and definitely kids get from coming to camp, because it's that everybody's in the same boat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, it's not lost on me that diabetes camp, and this is crazy, but my Facebook group are basically the same thing.
Yeah. It's the sharing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a place to go to find other people and other voices, to get ideas when you don't have them, to bounce off things that you're not sure of, to, from my perspective, you can draw confidence from it.
Oh, yeah.
When you don't have any.
Yes, that peer support and just the fact that you can belong and that you're understood.
Very important. Oh, sorry.
Yeah.
Sorry. Oh. My daughter's blood sugar just went over 120. Don't anybody laugh at me. Oh, she's high. Yeah. It's happening. Oh. She's 121. So, but even that, her blood sugar just popped up over 120. She's at college. My daughter's a sophomore in college. And I can tell you, I haven't looked at Arden's diabetes all day. It's almost 1 p.m. here. But by picking up this app, I can tell you that at 11:52, Arden bolus for 40 grams of food. That was 50 minutes ago. She's on a diagonal up right now. So you just heard her cross 120. I think she's at 138 right now. And in a couple of seconds, this algorithm is going to jack her basal up and push back with a small bolus. Mm-hmm. And it will turn around. Now, here's the crazy thing. Her 40 gram bolus ended up being just under 5 units. Let me do something here with everybody real quick, because we made this point earlier. So I hate having to wear glasses, Jeannie, to read. Like, it's like, it's now I'm looking back at the computer. I need it to be off again. Like, I'm like, why does the screen so blurry? I'm still wearing the stupid glasses.
The wrong glasses.
She's 40, right? And so 40 carbs. I think maybe her, like I said, her ratio is like 63 now. Back then, one unit did 42. One unit, what was her insulin to carb ratio before we changed all this? Right now, it's one unit moves her 63, one instead of 42. Her insulin to carb ratio used to be, this might freak you out, one unit moved her, one unit covered six carbs before. This bolus was 1.6 units less than it would have been before the Ozempic.
Yeah.
And that's just for 40 small carbs. It's really, it's great. And there's the spike, is to call this a spike is ridiculous. It's a drifting up arrow. You know, anyway, between the technology and the community and stuff like this, where I've now had 1,000 conversations with people with diabetes, like you even think now, like you'll look back on your episode. Everybody does this, by the way. They look back and they go, oh, I didn't help. I didn't add anything to it. And I always laugh when I say everybody thinks that, but yet all that information's there and everybody loves it. And I'll ask them, like, you love the podcast, right? And they'll say, yeah. And I was like, well, what did you get out of it? So that other person's story, I learned this little bit, I learned that little bit, but I didn't say anything today. And I'm like, that's not true. Your story's really valuable. What we need is the ability to pluck out the gems and show them to you, you know? So it's all coming. It's happening very quickly. Jeannie, let me tell you the truth. I'm going to sit in this room until I can leave something behind that I know my daughter can use. You know what I mean? And the rest of you get to use it too. But, you know, I'm doing it for her. So,
yeah.
Anyway.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So tell me something. You still know people from diabetes camp?
So I went in 65 as a kid. And then, you know, my life as a nurse, and I was working Kaiser, and I was helping out with their pediatric diabetes clinic one day a month. And the group, DYF, Diabetes Youth and Families here in California, they offered a back to school conference day for the parents. You know, it was, you know, August. And I went to, you know, help out with the kids camp because the counselors from DYF came and took care of the kids while the parents were listening to people talking about going back to school. And I was looking and I saw these pictures and I said, you know, I might have gone to that camp. The long and the short of it was, well, we need nurses every summer because each deck of kids has their own nurse. And they said, why don't you come to camp? I don't know. I mostly do adults. And they said, well, come to teen camp. So I volunteered for two summers at teen camp, hung out with Dr. Mary Simon, who's the medical director. And I just loved it. I hung out with her all day long. I didn't go do the hikes or off to this part in Kings Canyon National Park. I stayed there and just absorbed everything she wanted to teach me. That summer, at some point in time, they had a phone conversation. Dr. Steve Gittleman was on the call. Other nurses and doctors who came and volunteered at camp were on the phone call because they felt they needed an assistant for Dr. Mary. She was running the medical side of camp all by herself, and it was just too much for one person. So after this phone call, my parting words were, well, think about who you know who likes camp, who you get along with, and who you'd like to spend more time with, and give them a call. How are you going to advertise this job? Well, a couple of days later, I got the phone call. So I asked my husband, I said, well, they want me to go to camp, be the assistant medical director. It'll be gone for 2 months every summer. Can I do it? And he said, yes. So I started in 2004, and I'll be heading back up in June to do it again. So that's my summer vacation, is up at camp. I love it.
You've been doing that for 20 years or more.
20 years, yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Good for you.
Oh, it's just, you just feel, well, like you feel like you're in the right place, doing the right thing. talking to people, sharing, getting people to connect and share and learn and feel good about themselves, the kids. It's just, it's a break for the parents. The kids are like off playing, or the parents just drop them off and they go, or they put them on the bus. And so they've got these 6 or 10 days free without having to wake up, without having to worry about what their kids are doing. And it's so important for everybody. And the kids, the endocrinologists, they talk about, you can tell a kid who's gone to camp. They're more talkative. They are more involved in their care. They understand, they have confidence in what they're doing. But it just makes such a wonderful growth impact. And every summer that they come back, this change lasts a little longer until they kind of graduate from camp and come back as counselors to be able to work with the kids. So it's just a wonderful community. And DYF even has a babysitting list.
And Jeannie, that's what they get out of it. What do you get out of doing it?
Just the joy. The joy of being useful. You know, you get up in the morning and kids start coming in with bad sights and you're helping them make a change. You want to change? Shall we change your sight? Do you want to try a different infusion set? I've got a wonderful school nurse who comes up and with the youngest camp, and she's my pump room nurse. So she's in there dealing with these kids too. And it just being useful, helping people to feel stronger, better, excited.
Gee, that's just wonderful. That's beautiful. Did you almost cry?
Yeah.
Because you almost made me cry. And I was like, what the hell's happening?
You get teary because you think, I mean, there's kids who come up and are just angry and unhappy. They don't want to be there. And then as the days go by, they make friends. And then when they leave, they're thinking, wow, I can come back next summer. Or, you know, and we've got a camp coming up in March. There's a spring retreat and there's a fall retreat, just a weekend thing. But people really like having these little bits of community, hands-on.
My daughter's away at college. And one of the most wonderful moments I haven't asked my wife about this, but that I've experienced with her is, it still happens. It happened the other day. She said, I made a friend today. And I thought, she's getting better at things and more mature. And, you know, all that's great. But she said, I made a friend today. And she was genuinely like happy about it. Such a big, big part of everything.
The DYF people, you know, the counselors, and the people who have moved on to become staff or just, you know, keep coming and circling back around. They're still good friends with people that they met at camp. It's almost like your college friends that you keep with for years and years and years because of the shared experiences, the shared struggles. Somebody understands.
A second ago, you said, it makes me feel useful.
Yeah.
And this is going to sound maybe crazy, but before the holidays this year, my family and I, we were having this conversation. And one of the questions in the conversation was, what's the thing you want to do that you stop yourself from doing that you don't do? You know, something you wanted to try or do or whatever. And I said, I almost surprised myself, but I said, I have always wanted a chameleon. And they looked at me very strangely. And I said, I understand they're very difficult to take care of. And there's a lot to know. And I'd like to learn something new. And I think they're very interesting. And I like how slowly they move. I think it would be relaxing. It was a philosophical conversation. Obviously, we were just talking out loud. Until my kids take me upstairs on Christmas morning to show me a chameleon they've been hiding in my daughter's bedroom for a number of days. Now, Jeannie, these are sincerely difficult to take care of. No one should buy them like this. I've spent the last 3 weeks of my life, every ounce of my free time, just immersed in information so that I can do a good job for this thing, because I have a caregiver's mentality with people, but with anything really. If you put me in charge of somebody, I am not going to stop trying to help them. It took me a couple of days to figure out the basics. I started, it's funny, I almost did it like diabetes. I was like, well, let me figure out what the basics are so nothing goes wrong in the first little bit here. And then I'll add my knowledge as I go. And I've done that now. But the other day, my wife said, how are you enjoying having the chameleon? And I said, I really like it. I feel useful. Because my kids are older now. Yeah, and I said to her, I'm like, this thing needs me. And I was like, you don't listen to me. We've known, I mean, Jeannie, I don't know if you're married or not, but I've been married like 27 years. My wife ain't listening to me anymore. You know what I mean? So like, she's not listening to me. She's an adult. She doesn't need me. And I realized how alone I have felt since my son went away, graduated, got a job. My daughter's off in college. I feel useless some days, even though I help people on a scale that I don't think a lot of people could imagine. It's not the same because I don't look them in the face when I'm doing it. So,
you know, and that's what I get out of doing the different support groups.
Yeah.
People ask questions and, you know, I'll share what I know, or I'll say, okay, well, let me look that up before, like at the first week of every month, I'm, you know, checking out Diatribe and checking out ADA. Is there anything new coming up? What questions might they come up with? What can I share? Mm-hmm. And so it gives me a reason to keep learning myself.
Yeah. I find too that anything I could do that would possibly help someone to not go through everything we went through to get to the information seems incredibly valuable to me. I even when I started doing this, the podcast started in 2015, but I've been writing about diabetes since 2007. And so when I started making the podcast, my wife was like, this is going to be a lot of work. And I said, yeah, I know, but can you imagine knowing all this and not telling somebody? That seems wrong, doesn't it? You know? And and that's sort of how I look at it, you know?
So finding a way to share.
Yeah. Finding a way to share something. And I think, and now the people listening do it for me too. It's facilitated. The one thing that I don't know if you've had this experience or not, it's very fulfilling. I watch somebody ask a question online, and then before I can get to it to answer, five other people answer it, and they sound like they're talking out of my mouth. Like they're using my thoughts, the things I said, to answer this question accurately. Yeah. And they're being supportive and lovely at the same time. And I think, oh, I created like helpers.
Oh yeah.
You know, like I'm going to help people that don't even ever hear the podcast. And it makes me smile. Like to think that kids who are recently diagnosed and adults who have been struggling for 30 years, they all end up having the same experience after they listen to the podcast. And so to think of all those people who are doing well in the world is really lovely. You know, it's a great feeling. And you've been doing it for a long time.
Yeah. And you probably remember when you were diagnosed, you just were afraid. Your daughter, you know, this, how can you keep this little girl healthy and happy and growing, and to be so alone and so scared. And so that's where, you know, getting this community going, finding the resources, you know, having like up at camp, endocrinologists to talk to, counselors who have had type 1 diabetes for many years, and just other families, and how do they make it work? And it's just the value of community.
Yeah. No.
It's huge.
It's hard to believe, I think, for some people, especially newer people. And I've even seen people say, I don't want to do that. Like, I don't want to meet a bunch of people I don't know. And like, I get that overall feeling. I have to honestly tell you, if I wasn't doing this, I don't think I'm the type of person who would go to a Facebook group to get help. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't know that I am or I'm not. Like, I'm not sure. But what I end up seeing is that, honestly, most people interact quietly. They're looking, they're reading, they're learning, they're following. They are not talking most of the time. You don't actually hear from them.
Yeah.
And that's pretty amazing, because in person, you have to engage people eye to eye. And if somebody's in the back of the room and not listening, there's not much you can do about them, about helping them, hopefully, or reasonably speaking.
Yeah.
This is different. Like, this is like you're broadcasting it somewhere and they don't have to tell anybody.
Yeah.
Like, there are people listening right now in their cars, in their ears, who have, the people around them don't know they have diabetes.
Correct.
You know, and so that gives them that freedom too, yeah. Which is a big deal. It addresses a lot of different roadblocks that people have getting to the good information, mm-hmm. and the community too.
And something that I try to remind people, you know, when I'm talking to them about coming to one of my Facebook groups, is like, you don't have to show your picture. You don't have to be there. You don't have to talk, but just listen. Mm-hmm. And if you have a question, then you can ask it. You can ask it in the chat. You don't need to be seen, but just come and listen.
I left the anonymous function on my group. Mm-hmm. Because it's problematic sometimes, but for the most part, I think people should be allowed to ask their questions without giving up their identity if they want to.
Right.
Because I think otherwise they wouldn't be able to do it.
Mm-hmm. Because there's a lot of things that we're ashamed of. Mm-hmm. We think we should be able to do this better, but dadgummit, we just don't do the right thing. And does anybody have any ideas? So
yeah, no, it's very helpful. So
yeah.
If I was going to ask you, mm-hmm. what do you think the keys are to diabetes? You've been listening with it for a long time. Can I ask you what your A1C is first?
Usually 5.9-ish.
Do you have an eating style?
Low carb.
Low carb. Have you been low carb for a long time?
Yes. I read Richard Bernstein's book, oh golly, probably 30 years ago. And I just thought, you know, that makes sense.
And it worked. Carb, and it worked for you. It's excellent.
Less insulin, less error. It just works for me.
Yeah.
And but I know that a lot of people that doesn't work for, but that's okay. You know, it works for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, it obviously worked. I mean, that whole concept is rock solid. You know, the fewer carbs you eat, the less insulin you're going to use. The less insulin you use, the less variability you'll see. Fewer lows, mm-hmm. you'll have to correct. Like that all is obviously it's obvious, right?
And I love vegetables, so that's a great thing.
So it's easier for you. When I started the podcast, I started with the idea that I wasn't going to be able to impact how people ate. I wasn't going to be able to impact how they exercised. Like those lifestyle things, those are bigger problems in the world that, you know, smarter people than me have not been able to figure out.
Right.
Right. How do you mass teach that kind of health to people and forced compliance, basically. And I thought, I couldn't do that. That's silly. I'm going to say, it's how you use insulin. Get your settings right. Learn how to use insulin. Apply it to your lifestyle. Because whether whether you get up in the morning and have a plate full of vegetables and an egg, or you get up in the morning and you're, I don't know, walking out of a convenience store with a soda and a honey bun in your hand, you don't deserve diabetes complications. What I mean? Yeah, right. So
how can you use the insulin so that you're happy with your life?
Yeah, that's it. Super simple. Like, so that's my perspective always and always. Learn how to use insulin so you can do what you want to do with it.
Yes.
I'm not the food police. Mm-hmm. I'm not the exercise police. That seems like an unwinnable job to me. That's just where I've come from. And I found that generally speaking, that message from that perspective has been really well received by a lot of people.
If somebody gets really happy by having apple pie a la mode every Sunday for dinner, and that's what, you know, they look forward to, and they want to pick up their Starbucks every morning, and it helps them start their day.
Yeah.
Go for it.
Yeah. Because if you take that from them, you're going to get into the psychological side of this then.
Yeah. You know, there's enough. We've got to deal with insulin, no matter how you take it. There's quite a few people I know who are on MDI, mm-hmm. and they feel that works for them.
I know plenty of people who do well on MDI.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And the truth is the podcast, with the exception of talking about an algorithm or an extended bolus or the ability to shut off your basal, you have all the same options that everybody else does. You know, mm-hmm. yeah. It all comes down to how frequently you're willing to inject.
Yeah, yeah. If you don't mind being a pincushion, you like doing the math in your head, you can keep track of insulin on board, or you've got an InPen that keeps that for you. It's doable.
Yeah, it's incredibly doable, actually. But you have to be right for it, for sure.
And then that's the fun reason to be able to share is so that people can learn that this is out there. Mm-hmm. Our you know, medical team, our endo team, is not necessarily going to say, you know, you like doing shots. Have you thought about using an InPen or an iPort?
Yeah.
Well, those are still around.
InPen's a great tool, by the way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. It gives you a lot of functionality of an algorithm, actually. You get to see stuff on the phone app and make better decisions, keeping track of things for you, showing you where insulin is. You can compare what you've done to what you're seeing and make different decisions next time. There's a lot of value in that. You know, it's funny with the way we talk about it. You'd think overwhelmingly the people with type 1 diabetes are wearing pumps, but that's not true, actually.
Up at camp, it's probably about 75-80% of the kids are on pumps.
Mm-hmm. But I mean in the world, like overall. Yes. I think the percentage is low, actually.
Yeah, the Bay Area, you know, is just there's a lot of people on pumps here. But you go out into the lower populated communities and you're not necessarily going to have an endo team that feels comfortable with pumps. And so they're not going to prescribe them because they just don't know them.
You know, it's funny. I tell this story sometimes, but when my daughter was four, we wanted to put her on an insulin pump before she started kindergarten.
Sure.
And we went to basically an insulin pump fair at the children's hospital. It's exactly what it was, actually. And, you know, this is 2009, 10, around then, maybe. Mm-hmm. And Omnipod was a very new company. And there were all these pumps laid out on these tables. They almost felt like they were under glass with a spotlight on them, like you were walking through a museum. And then back in the corner of this room, in this cutout corner of this room on a table, there was a box that looked like, the way I always put it is, it looked like somebody was told, take this box and put it on that table in the corner. But they got 10 feet from the corner and didn't want to walk anymore and threw it at the wall and it bounced onto the table. Like, that's how it was sitting there. And I went over and looked at that and it was an Omnipod. And I brought my wife over and I said, I think this makes a lot of sense to me. I was like, there's no tubes. And if the company makes upgrades to it, I'm like, what are they going to do? Make like 17 versions of this? You're always going to get the newer upgrade, right? Like, that makes sense to me. Like, this looks forward thinking. These were my ideas. And I went to the nurse who said, which one have you decided on? I said, we're going to get this Omnipod. And she goes, oh, don't do that. Now, this again, a long time ago, you know. And I said, why not? She goes, and she looks at Arden. She goes, she's too lean for that. And I said, well, we're going to try it anyway. And I took it away. 2 years later, at an appointment, after our appointment was over, the nurse practitioner pulled me aside and said, I want you to know that based on the results that Arden has had on Omnipod, we are now going to start prescribing it to other kids in this practice.
2 years. Wow.
2 years later. And I said, can I ask you, why did you try to stop me when we got it? And she got almost embarrassed and said, well, it was newer and we didn't know much about it. And we didn't want you using a pump we didn't know how to support. I said, but that's not what you said. What you said was she was too lean for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, 6 years ago, I realized that I was hearing more about Loop. And I thought, and one summer I had two campers and one family on Loop. And I said, Jeannie, how can you be the camp nurse and not know Loop? So I came home. I saw Rehan Lal from Stanford at a fair that was happening. And he was working with someone on Loop. And I said, you guys, I need to learn this. And so they connected me with a counselor who was in a study at Stanford and who wasn't using her Loop. And they said, borrow hers. So 2 weeks later, after trying it out, I thought, dadgummit, it works for me. So I ordered my own and I've been on it ever since. And now I've just been talking with Beta Bionics. I said, I need to know Islet. I need to wear it. I need to experience it because there's already one DYF family using this Islet pump. So I need to be able to problem solve or answer their questions. So hopefully I'll be able to get on one.
Yeah.
And just wear it for a couple of months.
I'm going to have people on who have worn it. Like, it's hard to find them at the moment, but I'm looking for them to have them on.
Katie Kraft from Oakland Children's. She's a child life specialist.
Yeah. Tell her to contact me. I'll have her on. I'd love to hear about it. So my expectation about it, you know, I've interviewed this CEO. I actually did a very long interview with him. And my expectation is for most people, especially those who are not doing well, this is going to give you an A1C in the sevens. And right. that's going to be magical for you because you've had an 8, a 9, a 10, 11, a 12, whatever your A1C has been.
That seems to be for me also the population.
Yeah. And I think that's really magical.
Teenagers.
Yeah. Right. Just you're going to save people's lives and they're not going to know their lives are being saved. Like that's a big deal to me. Mm-hmm. You know, like because it's easy to say, I help people in a Facebook group or I help people at a diabetes camp or I have a podcast that reaches all these people. Jeannie, I'm pretty comfortable telling you that I'm reaching more people with diabetes than probably the next five people reaching a lot of people combined. And I am not reaching nearly a small percentage of them.
Enough.
Right. Yeah. And most people are not putting this kind of effort into their health. And if you could take away that, then I think you've really done something at that point for the population.
Right. Yeah, that's going to be exciting.
Yeah, no, for sure. Now you got to get it on him. And I told him when we were talking, in fairness, he already knew, but I said, I think you're going to have to like target general practitioners because most people aren't even going to an endocrinologist.
This Ed?
Yeah, I talked to Ed. That to me makes sense. Like I think his pathway to like expansion is talking GPs into putting these things on to them, mm-hmm. you know, because they're going to have more interaction with people than the endos are going to a lot of times.
Right.
You got to get it commonplace so that you can help them, mm-hmm. you know, and you're not going to help everybody, obviously, but I think you have a good chance at reaching a population of people who were otherwise not going to be helped.
That's one of the exciting things about, you know, being able to share. This is available. Check it out. Mm-hmm. It could make your life a little more livable 10 years from now.
Yeah. Yeah, no kidding. Or a lot, honestly. I mean, mm-hmm. seriously. I mean, is there any way your A1C was better than 7 when you were in high school and college? No, right?
Oh, luckily, we have no idea.
Luckily, we have no idea. And he's like, I don't want the answer to that question.
Yeah, just like a typical high school kid, you know, eating wrong food. I remember taking a grapefruit and having that for lunch at school. You know, it was like, how is this enough carbs, you know, for the insulin that you took? So
you feel lucky to be alive sometimes?
Yes, I do. I feel very blessed. Yeah. But it was just, you know, having a supportive family, because that family team, you know, starts out being so important when your kids are little. They need to be helped, encouraged. You know, we've got kids, like when your daughter was 12, you probably were a teen. You helped her with all the diabetes tasks.
Oh, for sure.
But some kids by 8, 9, 10, it's that yo-yo. You're on your own. Mm. I've got too many other things, or I don't understand. And so it's creating that attitude of can-do and having the support. So
I agree. I mean, because what you're saying is it's almost depressing, but you know, everybody doesn't get a parent who's on top of it.
Correct. And, I mean, my mom didn't work. So that was a wonderful blessing. That was still in the era when you didn't have to have two jobs to have a house.
Oh, I often tell people that a lot of the value that I bring to diabetes is because I actually was a stay-at-home parent. I was able to focus on it. And really figure it out. And then once I figured it out, I was able to write about it, which taught me how to talk about it. And then, like, you know, I had the opportunity. I always tell people, if you want to thank somebody, thank my wife, because she was paying the bills while I was doing this.
Neat.
Yeah. Neat. Yeah. You just get some luck there, honestly.
That parent thing. I two people in my life. One was a social worker from UCSF, used to come up to camp every summer and talked about kids in the foster system who had no support or could not be adopted because everyone felt challenged by type 1 diabetes. Mm-hmm. And there's another lady currently who is retiring from being a foster parent, but she's had quite a few kids through her house because she has type 1 herself.
Yeah.
And she understands and can encourage and lead. she was saying, do you know of any foster parents who would be, I've got a gal who needs a home. And it's like, oh, Lord. Mm.
You know, it's funny when you say that. Doesn't it make more sense to just have one home where everybody with type one goes and you send a few people who understand them, and in 6 months you can get them helped and able to handle themselves so that they are adoptable at that point?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Why does nobody fix things the way that makes sense?
Yeah, you know, because there's too much bureaucracy, probably.
Yeah, it just makes
sense.
You
know, you've got a wonderful type one family who would be more than happy to take in a kid, but they're not licensed as a foster family. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I understand. Yeah. But dadgummit, you need to.
A kid's going to end up in a bad way.
Like, oh, yeah.
For sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm. You're not just going to randomly figure out diabetes by yourself.
Oh, heavens, no.
No.
It's way too complicated.
Yeah.
It needs to be felt doable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then you need some tools. You know, you need to know when to use them.
Yeah.
And then you have to have a couple successes so you can build on top of them, get a little self-confidence, start making decisions about numbers and then you're on your way.
Yeah. Confidence was a word that just came into my head when we started this point. Mm-hmm. The confidence to know that you can do this.
Yeah.
So important.
Yeah. Just the feeling that it's going to work out. You know, it's funny when I talk to people when they're really newly diagnosed and I'm in private, if I get a good vibe from them, I'll tell them at the end, like, you're going to be fine. I can tell. And mm-hmm. they're like, how can you tell? And I'm like, well, you're asking questions and you seem interested in the answers. I think that'll get you there.
That's exactly what I was said in my head. You're asking questions. You want to learn more. You want to feel like this is your disease and you're sharing your life with it, but you're leading.
It's the desire to do better and the effort it takes.
Oh, because it does.
Yeah.
And then it finally becomes second nature in a way.
Oh, that's what I say all the time. Eventually, you won't think about it. You'll just, a thing will happen and the next thing you do will be the right thing. And that's that. Yeah. I describe the way I think about diabetes now. It's like walking out of a room with a closed door. My brain does not say, walk towards the door, stop, reach out, grab the knob, turn the knob, pull the door, walk through the door. That's not how I walk through a closed door. It just happens. I've done it so many times. It just happens, right?
Yeah.
And diabetes is the same for me. When stuff happens, I can look, assess, and answer in a split second.
Yep.
Doesn't come right away, but it does come. You need the experiences. You have to have them over and over again. You have to not beat yourself up when something goes the way you don't want it to, but step back and say, all right, this is what happened. What did I want to happen? What obvious mm-hmm. thing, which one of these tools would have changed that? And then eventually one day you don't have to think like that anymore. You just walk through the door. So,
yep.
Anyway. Yep.
Resources to learn.
Mm-hmm. That's all you need. Jeannie, you are delightful. Is there anything we haven't talked about that we should have?
Yes.
What do you got?
Scholarships.
Oh.
Camps are expensive. The reason why families don't necessarily go to camp is because transportation can be an issue and the cost. And the different camps that I called do have their own scholarships. So most camps have their scholarship. So once you apply, that would be a part of the application. And the fact that transportation, I know that DYF has buses. There's a bus that leaves Pleasant Hill and San Francisco and Fresno. So picks up kids at different areas and drives up into the mountains. So that was the most valuable thing. And if people want to learn more about diabetes camps or why to go to diabetes camps, just put that question into your browser. Why go to diabetes camp? Because there are plenty of papers, studies out there that talk about the things, the blessings onto the children, what they come away with, and how valuable that is to their health and confidence.
Okay.
So just encouraging people to research. And there's DECA, Diabetes Exercise and Camping Association. They hold a yearly conference. So for all the diabetes camps around the world, people can come together and share best practices or share challenges. You know, how did you manage COVID? talking about, what are you going to do so that you can open up camp again? It's just so worth it to think about. So maybe even check for weekend situations, weekend camps.
Jeannie, because I still had the browser open in front of me, I just asked an AI model, why is diabetes camp valuable? And it came up with 8 bullet points: education, peer support, empowerment, skill development, fun and recreation, networking for families, building resilience, safe environment.
Hey, I've got those words written down on my paper right here too.
Is that crazy? Isn't that something?
Yeah.
I'm telling you, Jeannie, it's all going to happen just like this. One day a doctor is going to say, holy God, you have type 1 diabetes. And they're going to spin to a computer and say, how much do you weigh? And they're going to type it a little bit and they're going to, boom, here, do this.
Yeah.
By the way, that is the basis. That's me. I know you don't know this, but I have a pro tip series.
Fun.
It's at episode 1000 in the podcast.
Oh, yes. Scott was talking, or
Stephen talked.
Stephen was talking about
that. I know
that.
He's a fan of it, and I very much appreciate it when he talks about it.
Yeah.
I guarantee if you listen to that, your A1C will be in the sixes. And like that idea is just, amazing. So I asked this AI model, what are the key takeaways from these episodes? And it breaks them down for me. And then I said, can you also give them to me in Spanish? And there they were. Can I have them in Hindi? And there they were.
Yeah.
And I thought, this has been the one sticking point I've had making this podcast all along. People come to me all the time and say, can you translate it? And I'm like, I don't speak another language. And, having someone translate, it's impossible. Like, you'd have to hire 2 voice actors and it would just be incredibly expensive and I don't think it would even work. And then all of a sudden, this computer technology comes along and I just say to it, hey, what are the key takeaways? Tell them to me in Spanish too. And there they were.
Yeah. Well, we're lucky that we've got, here in the Bay Area of California, it's a large Hispanic population also. And so there are usually two camps every year that are done in Spanish.
Excellent.
Because there's enough nurses and doctors who are fluent in Spanish. And that's such a huge...
Do you know that people are in such need of that kind of help? I was once flown to the Dominican Republic to give a talk about diabetes to a group of people that overwhelmingly did not speak English. And while I was speaking, there was a translator in a soundproof booth. And she was, I was speaking and then I was watching her speak. And everyone in the audience was wearing headphones. They were listening to her, not to me. That is the kind of effort that had to happen for that to go on. And now just boom. Hey, can you translate this? They say, by the way, soon, Jeannie, you're going to be able to pull out your cell phone while you're talking to a person who's speaking another language. You're going to be able to speak into the phone in English and it's going to spit out what you're saying in another language and then hear them and then tell you what they're saying.
Yeah.
It's crazy. Crazy.
What a life.
Yeah.
What a life.
I'm going to try to stay alive longer. I want to see what's going to happen next.
Hey, I've easily got 20 more years in me.
Good for you. I bet you do. All right. Well, thank you so much for doing this. I really do appreciate
Scott,
it.
Scott, what a joy. Thank you so much for your patience with me.
Oh, you mean your emails? They were not, I just don't answer them. So I'll apologize to you at the end. I am not responsive. I get so much email, I get overwhelmed by it.
I figured, yeah. Well, Stephen answered me on one of them, so that was helpful.
I'm glad. Do you know what episode Stephen was in?
No.
I don't either. He's so good. I love talking to him about diabetes.
He comes up to our we have an adult weekend. He's involved in some of the support groups the Zoom groups that I do, so... I get to see him a couple times a month.
Yeah. He's in episode 828. It's called Stephen Appleseed.
There we go.
Thank you very much.
828.
Yeah. Thank you for doing this. Hold on 1 second for me, okay?
Yes, Scott.
A huge thanks to Touched by Type 1 for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast. Check them out on their website, touchedbytype1.org. or on Facebook and Instagram. A huge thanks to US Med for sponsoring this episode of the Juice Box Podcast. Don't forget, usmed.com/juicebox. This is where we get our diabetes supplies from. You can as well. Use the link or call 888-721-1514. Use the link or call the number, get your free benefits check so that you can start getting your diabetes supplies the way we do from US Med. I want to thank the Eversense CGM for sponsoring this episode of the Juicebox Podcast. Learn more about its implantable sensor, smart transmitter, and terrific mobile application at eversensecgm.com/juicebox. Get the only implantable sensor for long-term wear. Get Eversense. If you or a loved one was just diagnosed with type 1 diabetes and you're looking for some fresh perspective, the Bold Beginnings series from the Juicebox Podcast is a terrific place to start. That series is with myself and Jenny Smith. Jenny is a CDCES, a registered dietitian, and a type 1 for over 35 years. And in the Bold Beginnings series, Jenny and I are going to answer the questions that most people have after a type 1 diabetes diagnosis. The series begins at episode 698 in your podcast player, or you can go to juiceboxpodcast.com and click on Bold Beginnings in the menu. If you're looking for community around type 1 diabetes, check out the Juicebox Podcast private Facebook group, Juicebox Podcast Type 1 Diabetes. But everybody is welcome. Type 1, type 2, gestational, loved ones, it doesn't matter to me. If you're impacted by diabetes and you're looking for support, comfort, or community, check out Juicebox Podcast Type 1 Diabetes on Facebook. Thank you so much for listening. I'll be back soon with another episode of the Juicebox Podcast. The episode you just heard was professionally edited by Wrong Way Recording. WrongWayRecording.com.